Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Tina Horn, and you're listening to episode 11 of Why Are People Into That? So last year, I was sharing a modest little office studio space in Bushwick in Brooklyn with an organization that I really admire, the Persist Health Project. Now, Persist is a peer-led organization that provides affordable healthcare to folks in the sex trades. If you remember the episode, Why Are People Into Naughty Nurses, that was Zill Goldstein, the clinical director of Persist. And the executive director of Persist is named Sarah Patterson, and I just love her to death and admire the work that she does in sex worker advocacy so much. So one day, if you can imagine us in our tiny little white-walled studio office space, sitting down in our desk chairs and talking for almost 2 hours about why are people into sex work. Now, pretty quickly, we determined that there were sort of two lines of thinking. There's why are people into hiring sex workers? Why are people into consuming sex work, being sex worker clients? And then, of course, there's why do people do sex work? What motivates people to do sex work? Since we talked for so long, I decided to separate that out into two different episodes. So today's episode, side A, is really more focused on the client. Why do people enjoy watching porn? Why do people go to strip clubs? Why do people hire private service providers like escorts and professional BDSM providers? And also, what are some of the complications and social stigmas of that desire? And how does that desire affect the sex workers themselves? This can be a really polarizing subject, and I'm aware that this is almost definitely our most political episode yet, so make sure that you have plenty of cash in hand, because we're going to dive right into why are people into sex work?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so happy that we are here chatting in our little studio in Brooklyn.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could introduce yourself for our listeners.
Okay. My name is Sarah Patterson, and I'm the executive director of Persist Health Project.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Persist is and what it does?
Great, yeah. Persist is a peer-led project that links sex workers with health services that are non-judgmental and affirming. And so we sort of guide folks through that process. It's kind of like care coordination, if you've ever heard of that. It's like folks call us and they let us know what kind of services they need. And then we find a provider that fits them. And then sometimes we accompany folks to their appointments as well.
That's so awesome. And how did you come to do that work?
Well, I've been in sex worker activism now for going on a decade, a little under a decade. And I used to work for Spread Magazine when I was in college. And after I worked for Spread Magazine, I worked for the Sex Workers Outreach Project for some time and started doing some educational stuff for them. And I just saw a lot of my friends and my community members who had transitioned into doing healthcare, who were either working less or didn't do sex work anymore, and they became health professionals or service providers. I think there's a lot of overlap between those two things. And I also saw a lot of places in the city where sex workers weren't getting great healthcare. And I knew sex workers who just didn't know where to go, or the places they wanted to go were at capacity or just tapped out in terms of what they could offer. So part of this is the idea that our community can take care of itself and it can do it better than other people can. And so why not? And that's kind of the idea behind Persist.
It's fucking rad, Sarah Patterson.
Thank you.
Well, we were talking about the difference between the question, why are people into sex work, you know, sort of the two different branches of that are, why are people into doing sex work, and why are people interested in hiring sex workers? And we were just having a little bit of a conversation and finding out that maybe we're actually not necessarily of the same mind, where I sort of feel like talking about why people are interested in hiring sex workers is not necessarily about let's support sex worker clients and give them lots of sympathy and give them lots of space, because probably they actually already have quite a lot of that if they can afford to spend $300 for an hour of entertainment and pampering. But also I feel like demystifying what those motivations are is actually can be really helpful for demystifying sex work in general, and can be, you know, can those conversations can be also good for sex workers. And I'm wondering what you think about that, or if you also think that, like, that is just a big waste of time.
No, I mean, I think, well, let's take, for example, like, demystifying why people watch porn. That always usually goes pretty tragically, right? It's like these conversations where people are like, oh, why do people watch porn? Which almost goes immediately into, why are people addicted to porn?
Right.
Right? That's like almost instantaneous with most conversations about it. Or like, why do people need porn? Like, surely they don't, like, why should they need it? Or something along that line.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, that there are a lot of really major differences behind the motivation and also social stigmas around being a porn consumer, going to strip clubs, hiring escorts, hiring someone for BDSM services, hiring cam shows, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There, each comes with its own bag of stigmas.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously not as many. I think that it's fair to say the stigmas that come with those consumers of all of those services and entertainments are not anywhere near as potentially life-threatening as the stigmas that face the people who provide those services and entertainment. But the stigma is still there, and I guess that they're, like, intertwined. But yeah.
Because of the secrecy of both elements of it? And or just the shame?
The
both?
Secrecy and the shame, and I mean, I also think a lot of the ways that those industries are structured around secrecy and shame, and so many sessions themselves between the provider and the client have the smell of shame is everywhere, all in the air, and often informs the nature of the interaction, or even the nature of that person's specific interest, if you see my meaning.
Yeah, there is sort of, and I mean, there's, like, sort of a social concern element, too. I feel like I've even seen at straight jobs conversations happen between people about, like, oh, I went to the strip club last weekend, and then they're like, there can't be like a reasonable conversation about like, oh, how was the strip club? Was it good? Were there good dancers there? Right. Was there a particular lady you were interested in? Like, nobody has that conversation.
Gosh, it's so good that you spent so much money there instead of like, oh God, I left and all my money was gone because they hassled it out of me or whatever. Yeah, no, right. Totally. Nobody's going to talk about that. The tension is going to get really high pitched.
Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly. It's not like, you know, comparatively like, oh, I went to a restaurant and it was quite nice and the server was very lovely and I had this wonderful steak.
And I would go again.
Yeah. It's not, that's not the conversation that happens. Okay. And then there's like this immediate concern that like, why do you need to go to the strip club? Like, is there something wrong with you? Do you have a problem? I guess that's maybe, if I think about one of the origins of what immediately happens when someone talks about hiring an escort, or which probably happens much more rarely than talking about going to a strip club, people are immediately, like, concerned in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, okay, so... here is a specific scenario, like, we can talk about this. I can say that I once, a friend once approached me, a cis male friend of mine, saying that he had been having, I think, a hypothetical conversation with his girlfriend, in which they were arguing because she was saying that she felt that if he went to a strip club, that would be tantamount to cheating on her, because her reasoning was he was showing sexual interest in women besides her. So she would consider that cheating. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't want to cheat on her, then he shouldn't go to strip clubs. And he disagreed, but, you know, he was having sort of trouble articulating why. And so we had a conversation about it, and, you know, obviously every individual, I think, should be empowered to come up with their own boundaries around these things. But I think that sometimes people's boundaries are based on misconceptions or just sort of, like, frankly, ass-backward thinking about what it means to have sexual interest in someone other than your monogamous partner. And, like, for me, I think of going to a strip club as entertainment, and the sexual component of that is, like, a moot point to me, or, you know, ethically in terms of cheating. But at the same time, obviously you can't, I mean, it is sexual. Like, there are girls, like, naked, or mostly naked girls or people, like, grinding their ass in your face, right? It's meant to be sexually titillating. It's meant to be arousing. But, you know, it is a reality that people are interested in people other than their monogamous partners. And to me, it seems like having a chance to go and be entertained and have a little bit of variety and have a, like, to be able to blow off some steam in the context of something that doesn't have to do with intimacy or relationships, can be a really healthy part of a long-term monogamous relationship. But I'm curious what you think about that scenario, or that, like, sort of ethical question about whether or not, like, going to a strip club is cheating.
But do I think going to a strip club is cheating?
Well,
a really tough one.
I mean, do you think that it is? And also, what do you think about the opinion that it would be?
I mean, I had a similar scenario happen with a close friend of mine where her fiancé at the time went to a bachelor party that I think initially started as, like, a bar situation, and then they went to a strip club.
Right.
Or maybe it might have been that somebody hired strippers or something along that line. And she was annoyed that when he came home, he didn't mention that there had been strippers, which, knowing what I know about her fiance, is probably because he was getting drunk and not paying attention to the strippers. He probably didn't really care.
Mm.
But she was, like, very... She felt like there was a betrayal in the, like, not mentioning the strippers part of the story. That, like, that was, in some way, an infringement on their relationship. Because the lack of information sort of meant, like, why are we concealing? Yeah, like, what's the concealment for type of thing? It's possible that he thought it just wasn't relevant. Or it's possible that, you know, someone else hired strippers and he felt like it wasn't... his responsibility to let her know or something along that line.
Well, but... it's a vicious cycle, right? Because the... which comes first? The fear of judgment, which leads to perhaps what someone might consider a little white lie, or the, like, ethical issue itself that, like, if you are in a space where there are women behaving sexually, that you have a responsibility to disclose that to your partner. You know, it makes me think, like, would she have felt differently about it if at this party, women who are not professionals had, as sometimes people are wont to do, had, like, begun, like, behaving like strippers.
Right,
like standing up on tables or like taking off their shirts or like grind or making out or grinding up against each other. I'm told that this happens at parties sometimes. Like,
totally.
You know.
Yeah. I could totally see that. Yeah, that's totally it. Well, and that was interesting too, because she said to me afterwards, like, she had judgments about the people that hired the strippers. Like,
right.
I think it was like other friends of the guy who was getting married who like hired them for him. And she had, like, judgments about them and, like, their intentions for why they hired them in the first place. And it's complicated because, you know, I have friends who are strippers and I work with strippers. And, you know, that's, for me, that's, like, but I do immediately get worried, too, because I'm sort of like, oh, okay, well, what kind of men were they? Were they cool? Like, I don't know. There's some other, like, labor things that come up for me when I think about that stuff. But it is, I mean, you're bringing up something that maybe it's about monogamous relationships and, like, how to have communications around that. But also, like, we don't have really a common social conversation about, like, how do you talk to your girlfriend about going to strip clubs? I don't know, like...
Well, I mean, part of the reason that we... This is part of what I think that I'm getting at, is that there aren't a lot of, I think, commonly agreed upon ethics around how to talk to your partner about your interest in sexual entertainment, because there's so much stigma, so much shame, and so much repression, and so it's just like, let's not talk about it is this sort of prevailing attitude. Let's not talk about it, let's pretend it doesn't exist, let's, like, stuff our desires away, and then, but people are interested in those things, and people, even somewhat perhaps accidentally in this scenario that you're just describing, find themselves in situations that involve sexual providers, and then it leads to conflict because we don't actually really have a way to talk about that. And I mean, I don't know, I definitely have a utopian vision of a world in which sex work is not only legal, but also considered more like hiring a therapist or hiring, like, any sort of specialist with any sort of practice, and that perhaps, like, that doesn't mean that automatically everybody would be okay with it, but if there were more conversations about it happening out in the open, I feel like those conversations, I don't know, I guess I'm just biased. I think that conversations that happen out in the open are always healthier and always lead to healthier relationships with sexuality and communication between people. I don't know, what do you think of that utopian vision?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the fear for people is the like loss of control or the potential abandon that might occur if one were sexually stimulated outside of their relationship in any way.
Right.
I feel like that's particularly, particularly with strippers, I think that's the fear, right? Is that like, because hypothetically, you're not getting off at a strip club, hypothetically.
Right.
Right. I mean, sure, there are strip clubs where that service is available, but like for most of the formulas.
Ostensibly, anyway.
Ostensibly, yeah. You are just being aroused
right.
at a strip club. And so, like, I think sometimes the fear is like, oh, there's all this arousal is going to happen. Where's the arousal going to go? Like, is it going to be directed somewhere else? Is it going to be directed back into the relationship? I think that, like, uncertainty.
Is it going to be just released into the cosmos?
I think that's kind of what freaks people out, is which is ironic since we have a culture that does that to us, like, constantly.
Right.
In other ways. But, and maybe that's, I think that's why, at least from, just thinking about my own experience, like, knowing straight folks and straight couples and straight women, like, that porn is, I think, for most folks, tacitly accepted as something that, like, can be, it's self-contained, right? Like, you don't have to really interact with other people to get it.
Right.
You don't even really have to pay for it. It's right.
Even though you should.
Even though you should. It's right there. And it's sort of like that, there's, like, no other people that have to intermingle into your life in order for that to happen.
Which is an interesting distinction between porn performers and porn makers in general and most other sex workers, is that the camera and the whole production acts as, like, a mediary between the sexual provider and the infinite amount of people who will potentially be aroused by their service that they're providing. But anyway, that's another subject. But I mean, it's relevant because I think that it may be part of the reason that it is more tacitly accepted is that the porn consumer is like never actually meeting the person that they are being aroused by.
Right.
That is not their partner.
And I'll tell you what, I mean, when I used to work at Babeland, we had porn performers come in for an event once, and I consider myself a pretty cool guy. I thought I would be able to handle this very well, and, like, when struck with someone that I had masturbated to in my presence, I was, like, just slack-jawed, completely unable to have a conversation with them. I mean, I think I pulled it together, but I can imagine. So, like, when thinking about, like, this idea of arousal and, like, where it's directed, like, to have that person in front of you, I think is, like, nobody tells you how to talk to porn stars in a casual way and not look like a fool, so.
David Foster Wallace talks a lot about that in his
essay. So I lied. Some people do talk about it. I should have read it.
No, he talks about, in his essay on going to the AVMs in, I think, 1998...
That's right. I did read that.
He does talk a lot about the thing that you just articulated, about what it's like to talk to someone, the, like, mind fuck of talking to someone that you have, like, watched have an orgasm that you didn't give an orgasm to. But anyway, DFW.
Yeah.
But going back to what we were saying,
I mean, I guess it's just sort of a matter, people just don't know how to have these things in their life in a way that makes sense. I think that's part of it for people, is that people want sexual arousal, they want pleasure, they seek out things. Some people seek out things in the sex industry to find those types of things. And I think where that will lead freaks people out. About where is that going to lead? What's it going to turn into? How am I going to be able to compartmentalize this or not compartmentalize it?
And yet, it is happening everywhere, all the time. It is part of the, like, it's a deeply a part of the infrastructure of our society, of our economy, of social status, of gender relations, and it affects our consciousness every day, and yet people are like, well, I'm too scared, so let's just not talk about it. And yet, like, the ways that it, that these desires and exchanges between, you know, consumers and providers is all around us all the time. And I don't know. I wonder what the world would look like, how the world would be different if we were acknowledging all of that. I really do.
Well, what do you think acknowledgement would look like? Because that's such, I mean, there's like such a broad spectrum of what, of how we could do that.
Well, I mean, I'm not even, when I talk about my utopian vision of sex work, I'm talking about it more as a thought experiment, in how that would affect hegemony and ideology more than I am suggesting more than I'm suggesting like political action to change, because it would require political action, because the elephant in the living room with conversations about sex work, it to me is always the illegality or some things that exist in somewhat gray areas mm-hmm. of the law. And you know, another big difference between porn and stripping and other kinds of sex work like escorting is that escorting is illegal in most places in the United States, mm-hmm. In most places in the world, and has historically been illegal. Whereas, you know, certain kinds of live, you know, erotic performance and certain kinds of filmed erotic performance are not. And we could talk about why that is, but the fact of the matter is that it's illegal. So I'm not even necessarily suggesting that I think that it that we should take measure. Well, I mean, I'm not even necessarily saying that I think that sex work should be legal, but hypothetically, I wonder if sex work were legal and you could advertise openly, you could set up practice, you could get an official credential. So, for example, if you go to see someone to flog you, you know that you're not just going to get some girl who thought it would be, like, really cool to, like, put on stilettos and be a dominatrix who might potentially, like, rupture your kidneys, even though she looks really great. You know, you would actually, like, know that you were being flogged by someone who, like, had a credential in flogging from, you know, like, all of the awesome places that I know of off the top of my head that you can get, yeah. that you can go and learn flogging, but you don't necessarily, like, need a, like, license to practice it, right? So, like, that would be cool, because then everybody getting flogged would, like, actually know how to flog, and everybody getting choked out would, like, actually know to, like, press on the sides of the neck and not on the windpipe when you are playing. Choking someone. But anyway, just as an example. but, you know, how would that change things? Well, it would mean that you might not necessarily need to use another name when you are a sex worker any more than a therapist or a tattoo artist uses a different name, although obviously some... I feel like I've gotten tattoos from people named, like, Spider and, like, you know, Fern Absolutely. Dancer. Yep. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so maybe that's a bad example, but you see my point. So you could, you know, there's issues of safety. There's issues of if you have a credential and you have a practice, then perhaps you also can get healthcare, which is something that I think that you probably have quite a lot to say about how it would be different for sex workers to get access to healthcare if sex work were legal. And also, you know, which is, I mean, the deep irony of that lack of access is that sex workers, more than almost any other profession, uses their body as their tool in their profession.
Yeah.
In ways that, and when you use your body as a professional tool, that affects your health in many ways, all on the spectrum, from disease to also injury, and also just like care that you need, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, athletes get physical therapy, and, you know,
exactly.
Sex workers, it would be nice if sex workers could as well, like, as a direct result of the work that they do. So that's, you know, that's another example. And, you know, even if sex work were something that was a really outre thing to be, if it was legal, then, you know, it might not be as hard to tell your parents that you're doing it. It might not be as hard to tell the people that you're dating that you're doing it, and, like, you know, not have so much fear of being whore-shamed or slut-shamed or not being able to have access to certain things because of the stigma around it. You might be able to put it on your resume to get other jobs where it actually, like, might be relevant.
I mean, I guess that's what we're talking about from either side, is we're discussing, like, if you want to get sexual services, if you want to provide sexual services, you have to kind of step into this, like, orb of anxiety, this, like, panic that we've created around trading sex and sexual services. And then you get blamed for the orb being there in the first place. Like, why would you bring this anxiety into your life? And people are like, well, I didn't make the orb of anxiety. Like,
right.
Somebody else did. You all do. We all do together. Everybody does. And so that's kind of where the health impact comes in, is that, you know, having to constantly, I mean, we call it stigma, but I also think of it just seeing the way that it impacts people, it's also just like a low-grade panic that kind of just like permeates one's life around like different ways that sex work is going to insert itself into your consciousness, and how that's going to, or I should say, how the stigma of sex work is going to insert itself into different aspects of your life, and like how that's going to impact different things for you. Psychologically, it just has a huge impact on people in terms of like how they manage their day, how they manage their relationships, how they think about their resume, how they think about talking to a doctor, how they think about talking to their mother. Like, these are just all day-to-day things that, you know what I mean? That's the privilege of, that's non-sex worker privilege, right? Like, the privilege of not being a sex worker is that you don't realize that those things do impact sex workers' like day-to-day activities, and if you're not a sex worker, you don't think about those things because you don't have to. Except in the areas that we just talked about, where, you know, your boyfriend goes to a strip club, and then all of a sudden you're like, you're forced into, you can see the orb of anxiety then, and you're like, I'm anxious now. I don't know how to control this. I have feelings and I don't know how to deal with them, because, and so like the easiest thing to do is to like blame strippers for existing.
Right.
Or blame strip clubs for existing, or, you know, say things like, well, those women are exploited. I feel bad for them.
Right.
Those are, like, really easy angles. Well, not easy, but they're very likely angles to take when you're trying to not deal with the fact, rather than saying something like, oh, I grew up in a society where I have all this anxiety about sex work and I don't know how to deal with it, and, like, maybe I should do some processing about how I feel about this. Like, the likelihood of people saying that is pretty low.
Right.
When they could just say, like, strippers are dirty hoes and strip clubs are nasty, and why would any self-respecting man want to go to one?
And then it becomes I think that you're right. I think that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy then as well, because then because these conversations are you know, not quote unquote allowed to happen, then places do end up being literally dirty. Like, they are not as, they're not regulated or, you know, kept up. The conditions, what I'm trying to say is the conditions under which people are forced to work when they choose or don't choose to do sex work end up being not ideal conditions, in terms of safety, in terms of health, in terms of emotional well-being, also in terms of creating an optimal environment, you know, like, you're not necessarily able to create the best environment for your client when so much of what you do is shrouded in shadow, mm-hmm. and or affected by conditions of secrecy or conditions of being clandestine or being working with what you've got to stay off the radar.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually something that we've had a few conversations with and persist about in terms of, and when we do our health and wellness workshop, that is one of the things that we talk about in terms of how does our work environment affect the way that we feel about ourselves and the way that we think about our health. And I mean, you know, for people who work in a dungeon or a brothel, they might as well, from a landlord standpoint or from a city inspection standpoint, they might as well be squatting.
Right.
Like, you know, in terms of, like, how do you talk to the person who owns the building about it? How do you deal with the foot traffic? How do you, like, there are so many things to consider.
Well, and just, like, some of the squats that I know are higher functioning than some of the places that I know that are quote unquote legitimately rented because people come together or individuals decide to like occupy and take over that space and actually like create something that, you know, has running water and is clean and has a library and, you know, like has a practice space and, is a space where people can create art or whatever and is safe. And then some people squat in conditions that are like fucking disgusting by any measure. And, in my research, I have found that some, you know, dungeons, quote unquote dungeons, and which are usually not actually underground, but in like nice houses or apartments, yeah. or quote unquote brothels or quote unquote salons or whatever. Some of them are really nice and some of them are disgusting.
And I mean, I think, well, we also have to consider the impact that has on people long term too, because I think of folks that I know who have run brothels or dungeons for 15 years of their lives,
yeah.
and have had to like pick up and move,
yeah.
at a moment's notice because there was a new police commissioner in the area who was really interested in sex workers, or like because a law changes in your state and all of a sudden what you do isn't legal anymore, or
right.
it's like gone from being kind of on the line to being definitely illegal. And like, you know, that has an impact on the way people feel about themselves and the way they feel about their work, because like our career is for many people define the way that they think about themselves, the way that they think about the world around them. And so if the world is constantly telling you that you like can't build a legitimate business even if you want to,
mm.
like that it can never really be 100% legitimate because there's always this other thing in the way of that happening, or you know, in the case of strip clubs, like you can just have these insane regulations put on your strip club at a moment's notice,
right.
and you just have to suck it up and deal with it.
Yeah.
That, you know, that has an impact on how people feel about their own well-being. And it has an impact on, I think, you know, it goes down to, it has an impact on how they feed themselves, the type of relationships that they have, the type of housing situations they're willing to tolerate or not willing to tolerate. And it's sort of like, the type of education they seek out, the type of conversations that they have with people about their own well-being. It's just those things all, it's for me, it's all interconnected.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I have an acquaintance of mine, you know, started doing professional BDSM when she was 19 and worked in other houses and, you know, definitely like learned a lot of those houses, but also learned what she didn't like about the way that things were run, continued to move on. You know, not like letting anybody, you know, boss her, like having the self-respect to say, like, this situation isn't working for me, I'm gonna go try to find something else. Kept doing that for a little while until she decided to forge out on her own and set up her own little operation, if you will. And that operation grew and grew, and she started, you know, having other women working with her. And then she started an organization, eventually bought a house, and ran the BDSM organization out of her house for almost 20 years now. And, you know, in any other industry, or I should say in an industry that is quote-unquote legitimate, i.e. legal, this woman would be considered, you know, she's industrious, she has self-determination, she also, I can definitely say, you know, a lot of the reason that she made her own place was not necessarily out of greed, but out of really actually wanting to create a space that she felt was fair for women to do that work, as you know, fair as well as safe as well as open-minded, et cetera, et cetera. And in any other in a legitimate industry, this woman would be considered to be like this very admirable businesswoman and a role model. But you know, by the time she got to her mid-30s and was feeling like maybe it was time to like move on, you know, thinking about other careers that she would want, she had no, I think that she felt really trapped. And I think that that is a shame, because actually this person has quite a lot to offer the world. And because what she saw an opportunity.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
To capitalize off of the willingness of many, many, many people, mostly men, to pay for something that she was learning how to provide. You know, it gave her many opportunities, but now she also has like limited opportunities because of the illegality and the stigma around what she does and what she provides for other people to do. And I think that that's a shame.
And that's a really necessary redirect that needs to happen, because if you look at the literature, the very minimal literature on, and often not very good literature on the psychology, like the psychological, there's this conversation about the psychological effects of sex work on people. There is less known about the psychological effects of being a sex worker in the United States. And that's the distinction that needs to be made. Like, there's wonderful literature on, like, the psychological impact of being a Black person in the United States, right? And, like, that literature is not about how Black people are responsible for their own oppression.
Right.
But all of the literature that's, or not all of it, but most of the literature that's on the psychological impact of sex work on people suggests that sex work is inherently oppressive and doesn't look at, like, the psychological impact of trying to be a sex worker in a world that says that is just wrong because of the illegality makes it wrong, like, ergo one or the other, like, it's just conflated.
Well, and like, nobody's supposed to I have also heard the argument that you can't, that any sex worker that gets up in front of people and says, I chose to do this, I enjoyed doing this, yeah, I had bad days, everybody has bad days at any job, that's about the labor part, not the sex part, that she can't actually be listened to or trusted because she's traumatized as a result of...
Right. False consciousness.
Right. Which is bullshit.
And that's why there really isn't that... I mean, we talk a lot about sex worker stigma, and I think that that's vital and important, but I also think that there is a real dearth of, like, mental health information about, like, what the long-term psychological impact of consistently being told that your work doesn't matter or is wrong, or, like, you know, why didn't you become a doctor or whatever? Like,
well then that's interesting that what you're focusing on is wanting to see the long-term psychological effects of what you were talking about with, like, the aura of anxiety in our society from being a social worker, not the long-term effects of being a sex worker in the sense of being intimate with strangers.
Yeah, not the
like,
job.
Yeah, not yeah. The, like, the actual job itself, but what it's like to then try to live in the world, being somebody who has done that work.
Because I have a theory that, like, for instance, I'll just give you one example. There's some literature out there that suggests that, much like queer folks, sex workers are more likely to smoke than other people.
That's interesting.
Now, smoking is directly related to anxiety management for a lot of people. Like, it's a coping mechanism. Right. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of queer people smoke, is because they're coping with fucking depression all the time. Right? So, and it's like a way of, like, calming yourself down, like having something to do, like
having something
fidgeting.
That you can control, which is ritualistic and dependable.
Yeah.
Right.
And then, like, it's also a community thing because, like, you know, you're hanging out with other queers, they're smoking, you're like, it's a way of connecting to other people, and it's also a way of distancing yourself from people you don't want to be around. You need to leave a situation, you go outside and smoke. These are, like, ways in which people use smoking as a coping strategy. So there's some evidence that sex workers are also more likely to smoke than the average person. And
man, well, what else are you going to do when you're sitting around waiting for the phone to ring, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's also that, right? It's like, it's a time, it's a way to kill time. It's also, like, you know, a way to distance yourself from your work. Like, you get out of work, you want to relax, you want to chill, you smoke a cigarette, you have a cocktail, whatever. So I have a theory. I am not a psychologist, but I do have a theory that there are probably a lot of occupational, well, I hesitate to use the word occupational because, like I said, I don't think it's directly related to the job. I think it's related to the stigma and the anxiety, that people probably have long-term anxiety issues as a result of constantly dealing with stigma management. That stigma management relates to how people get, because I think that you're, like, sort of, particularly if you're, like, if you're working at a place that has a bunch of video monitors and there's, like, baby monitors in the room, people are listening to you, you have to, like, walk a client out, you have to make sure you do the secret handshake on the, like, way out, and, like, there's all these, like, cloak of secrecy things that have to happen, like, your heart rate is probably slightly above what it's supposed to be all day at work. So, and if you're working a shift, that could be like 6 to 8 hours. You could literally be spending 8 hours out of your day with, like, a low grade anxiety all the time.
Well, right. I mean, and the other side of that coin is that I think is seductive and attractive for people is that can also manifest as an adrenaline rush, right? And it can also manifest as just a feeling of a clandestine feeling of doing something underground and dangerous and interesting and iconoclastic, and then also even the sort of the rush that you get as a performer or as an artist as well, of going through all of those little rituals. But yeah, it also it's a double-edged sword, to mix metaphors, because on one hand, like, adrenaline rush is great. On the other hand, that also can, depending on the circumstance, can also end up looking like anxiety, or can start out one way and end up being another way, or be one day and another on another day. And maybe something that starts out as feeling like an adrenaline rush all the time eventually becomes more having to do with anxiety, and then you have to have a coping mechanism like smoking or other addictions. And I guess going back to what we were initially saying, I would argue that the circumstances that produce that anxiety have to do with social stigma and the consciousness and circumstances that stigma forces sex workers into, rather than the actual literal in a vacuum exchange, like trade of sex for money.
And that's so much to manage at one time. And you're totally right. I mean, there could be a lot of good stuff in that bag too. Like, just the idea that, you know, you're managing, what am I wearing? What does this client want? What am I doing today? How's management today? What's the situation where I'm working? Like, and then all of the privacy stuff and all of that going together, and also just like the performance of the actual sex work itself.
Yeah.
Is so many things happening at one time. And it totally, I mean, I think for folks it can definitely manifest as adrenaline, and then, like you said, the flip side of the coin, and anxiety, like, which actually, and when I think about sex worker activists and like sex worker activists who have stopped working or aren't only working sporadically or things like that, it's interesting because I think that like sort of need to like have that anxiety pumping or adrenaline pumping like comes through in the activism. Like in terms of burnout, like I see people push themselves really, really, really hard for free, since 99.99% of sex worker activism is done for free. I see folks work really hard, and that's the sort of transfer that like level of intensity over to something else as well. I mean, so maybe, of course, we haven't gotten into this, and this is always, it's so hard to say because the type of people who trade sex are so, so, so diverse, and it's so difficult to generalize any of it. But whether it does attract folks who like the personality development aspects of it. I mean, I feel like I've definitely known sex workers who were like, I'm an outsider, like, I want to do outsider things, like, this fits my personality, I want to develop more around feeling like an outsider.
Word.
But then also just folks who just get into it for many other different reasons. So that's not necessarily the reason why folks do it, but I do think that there is, you get tripped up in it, because folks may go into it for that adrenaline, that feeling of adrenaline of like being a performer and like succeeding at something, making something happen in a sex work environment. But then I see people, I think that the stigma is such a trap, because it's like, it gets internalized in ways that I think people don't always expect is going to happen. And it kind of like comes up in weird, it manifests itself in weird behaviors where I think folks don't even realize that it's like, it's internalized itself in that way. It's so insidious.
Yeah.
The anxiety is really insidious in terms of how it affects people's own internalized shame or their own feelings about their life. And it's sometimes difficult for us to see it right away as what it actually is.
Well, you know, you hit on something that's really interesting, because yes, there are obviously as many different motivations for wanting to be a sex worker as there are motivations to want to be a firefighter or an astronaut or a teacher or whatever. I think it's probably fair to say that every sex worker has their own experience of a personality shift, or I don't want to say split, because you know, that is its own personality split, to their own thing, but and I don't want to necessarily suggest that it has anything to do with mental health, but there is, you do have to be somebody else at work in a very literal way. Most sex workers use an assumed name. Most sex workers behave in ways that are not necessarily reflective of them, and perhaps even purport to have opinions that they don't actually have. They play a role. Mm-hmm. And some people, I think, relish the opportunity to develop that role for whatever reason, for artistic reasons, for coping mechanism reasons, for security reasons, for psychological compartmentalization reasons. But the truth of that actually is that in sex work, it's just more literal than how it is for everybody else. I mean, I think that I would ask, like, everyone listening to this program to stop and think about a job that they've had where they have felt like they had to be somebody that they're not. I mean, you know, first of all, you could be in a bad mood, and you have to be in a good mood at most jobs. Especially ones that involve interacting with clients. You know, you're feeling low energy, you gotta figure out how to be high energy. You are, you know, you find someone, disagreeable in some way, you gotta figure out how to make it seem like you find them, like, the hottest shit ever.
You only have to read Yelp reviews of restaurants to figure that one out.
Right.
You know, the server being nice, or the server seeming interested in whatever you're talking about, is an essential component of most people going out.
Right.
Having been a bartender for 5 years, it is not an essential component for me going out, because I totally get it. But you know, when you go out to dinner with someone and they're like, oh, the server is so, it's like, so nice.
Indulgent. Yeah.
Oh, she was so great that she did that. Or so great that he did that for us.
Right, I mean, it's part of what you're paying for instead of fucking staying at home and making yourself dinner.
Right.
Right. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I like the idea of, you know, sometimes when I get off work at my retail job in Soho, it's really jarring for a second to, like, go out to dinner or, like, go do some shopping, like, in the area, because all of a sudden I'm like, like, the tables are turned, and, like, somebody's like, do you need anything? And I'm like, oh, gosh, I do. I have questions. You know? Like, all of a sudden I'm not the one with the answer. I'm the one with the question.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, I think that the point of this conversation, as it could be the point of many conversations, is that sex work is just like other work, just with sex. And sex is a big deal for people and makes things very charged. And people bring a lot of baggage and a lot of preconceived notions to things. And it just also, you know, ironically, sometimes sex makes people behave in a very juvenile manner, even though technically it's something for grown-ups to do and engage in and talk about and entertain one another in.
And there's something to be said for the fact that so many folks who are in the sex trade are women or gay men.
Right.
Who are already already feminized into social service professions and service professions as service providers.
That's a really fucking good point. Yeah.
And so I guess, you know, when you think about folks who are very anti-sex work, you think about, you know, the ways in which girls are socialized and the way that they're told to perform their gender is very much in line with service provision.
And taught to be accommodating and to know how to pamper and indulge people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely a part of our programming as female assigned at birth folks.
Yeah, don't set boundaries. Don't be a bitch. Don't have a hard line, you know?
Yeah. Well, that leads me, you know, I mean, one thing that I really do kind of want to talk about, and I have an example that I feel like might stimulate this conversation or this line of conversation or be illuminating, is that kind of also part of what I want to talk about is, like, putting ourselves in the mindset of someone who of a sex worker client, and the example that I want to give is I've recently had the opportunity to in my research to become aware of a sector of sex work that I didn't really know that much about before, and that is erotic massage. Suffice it to say, I've recently learned that, Midtown New York, Midtown Manhattan, is crawling with handjob parlors, mm-hmm. Mostly in residential apartment buildings, some in, like, office buildings in Midtown Manhattan. And
dungeons, although to a lesser extent.
Totally. Also dungeons, peppered here and there for a little kick.
Folks do not walk around the 30s and the 40s looking for these places.
Yeah. But they're there.
Look for advertisements instead.
Yeah, right. And the thing that I found so mind-blowing about these parlors is that right now, like, it's, what time is it? It's 4:20 on a Thursday afternoon in October in New York City. Right now, I think it's safe to say hundreds of men, or somewhere near hundreds of cisgendered men, have the access and opportunity and somewhat social encouragement to a certain degree to, or encouragement for the curiosity to pursue an experience where they go to an apartment and someone that they find attractive, mostly cis women, it seems to me, will pamper and indulge them, laugh at their fucking jokes, pretend that they care about hedge funds or whatever the fuck, pretend that they care, that they like the same sports team and that they liked the same movies, or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, that this attractive person will be wearing, like, lingerie or panties or next to nothing or nothing, and will massage them, literally massage them, like, with lotion and shit, and then turn them over and give them a hand job in a very, you know, I mean, I think it probably varies from parlor to parlor, but in my experience, you know, in a very involved, erotic manner that's not just, like, mechanical. And then give them, like, a scrub down with perhaps Dr. Bronner soap and those loofah gloves. Give them a towel. I love them too, especially after a hand job. But anyway, and then, you know, continue to, smile and, you know, bat their eyes and toss their hair around and then send them on their merry way. And when I became really aware of this and, like, really saw it in action, it just made me realize, I mean, I don't know about you, but if I'm having trouble focusing in the middle of the day, or if I'm in a grouchy mood, or I'm feeling low energy, I do my best to rub one out. And if, like, I have the opportunity, it's one thing that's great about being a freelancer. Like, I will rub one out. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, wow, I have a lot more mental clarity and inspiration and stimulation. And I could work until, like, 10 o'clock. No problem. Like, I'm having my best ideas. Like, I feel fucking fantastic. And recharged. And, like, there are hundreds of men all day long in Manhattan, where many, many, many things are done for this planet, who are getting not only jerked off, but also, like, a fucking massage, which also is super clarifying and recharging and relaxing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so is, like, we were talking about with any other service profession. It's also really nice to have somebody, like, act like they care about your fucking problems or your fucking face.
Probably better than having three martinis at lunch.
I'm guessing. Yeah, probably better. And all of this is to say, can you imagine how different the world would be if women and trans people and gender queer people were told, socialized, brought up to believe that they were also entitled to that experience? Because there are a lot of, like, people who are not cis men working in Midtown right now who could use a fucking hand job. That is what I'm trying to say. There, you know, there's a
That's
lot of people.
The best ending to that story.
There's a lot of people in the world who could use a hand job right now. But, you know, so part of it is that
hand jobs for everyone.
Hand jobs for everyone is my motto. I mean, everything for everyone is my motto. But you know, so first of all, I'm just going to generalize for the sake of language and say women are not socialized to consider taking that time for themselves unless it's to shop, or their version of that would be like getting a pedicure, which is nice, but right. A pedicure is not a hand job. It's just not.
And sometimes I'm more concerned about the labor conditions at the nail salon than I am at the massage parlor.
It's another podcast. That's another podcast.
Totally. I mean, I have to think really hard about going to a nail salon because I have very ambivalent feelings about being charged so little for something that is for me so much. Like, to have someone rub my feet like that is really big for me, and then to only, you know, in New York you can get a pedicure for like $15.
Oh my god, you can get a totally decent one on the Lower East Side for like $8.
Which is crazy. I mean, that's just, I always end up tipping like almost 100% on things like that because I can't in good conscience not do it. It just, I have too many feelings.
Well, so there's that. There's like actually thinking that you deserve to take that time for yourself. There's the glass ceiling and the fact that women do not have as much cash on hand that they can just make disappear without anybody asking any questions. Mm-hmm. Which is what I often say when people are talking about, like, well, why do more men than women hire sex workers in general? You know, I really personally don't think that it has anything to do with men being hornier than women, because I know a lot of horny women, as I'm sure you do. Mm-hmm. As I hope many of our listeners do as well. And if they don't, I can introduce them to some horny women. But then beyond the permission to indulge, there's the permission to allow a stranger, or even to develop a professional relationship with someone, as we do, again, with tattoo artists, therapists, even the people that make our coffee, et cetera, et cetera, to develop an intimate relationship with a professional, such that you would, you know, allow them to not only touch your naked body and relax you and to be able to be receptive to that touch and accept that touch, but also accept it erotically and accept an erotic massage even from a stranger that you find very attractive, mm-hmm. or who is really, really, really good at pleasuring a woman. And I know a few people like that as well. I know it doesn't sound like it, but I'm speechless. You know, I feel like, if I think about this shit all the time, and if I had never considered a world in which women and queer people could do that in the way that cis men can, then a lot of other people haven't thought about it either. And I feel like we should. I feel like we should think about it. I feel like we should talk about it. I feel like we should change it, because I really think that actually, like, maybe, you know, and men are like, oh, like, women can't be politicians, women can't be CEOs, you know, because they're so, like, high strung and, like, they're such crazy bitches. Like, they wouldn't be if they were getting handjobs all day, you know? Like, oh, men are, like, so much, you know, and this is not, you know, I love men, but, like, when I say men, what I mean is the patriarchy. The patriarchy and those who are allowing the forces of the patriarchy to work through them and move through them and are accepting the perks that the patriarchy really, really right. wants to give them, you know. A lot of the times, I think that those people don't realize how good they have it with their fucking midtown, midday hand jobs.
And this is where the cult of anxiety comes in again, because... You know, anti-sex work feminists would have you believe that all of those women are exploited and there's no way to get those services without someone losing something. You know, and that goes, I mean, that speaks to the heart of our anxieties about capitalism too, right? As like there can't be a transaction if someone's not being exploited in it. And yes, I mean, I do think...
I mean, I think that's
I have
true.
Been known. I have been known to say things like, if you are at your job, you're probably being exploited in some way. That is the nature of all jobs.
I have also been known to say that.
So it's...
That anxiety also doesn't get talked about because, you know, and I feel like that anxiety should get talked about too. The anxiety of the exploitation of labor.
Yeah, and why should I feel more guilty about going to a massage parlor than I do about going to Walmart?
Right.
Because I...
Or going and getting a pedicure.
Or going to get a pedicure, because I feel pretty guilty about going to Walmart. So, but is it as much as I feel guilty about going to a massage parlor? I don't, you know.
Yeah.
I think for most people, it's the massage parlor that wins out as the most guilt-ridden. But I suppose that goes back to what you're saying. Like, I mean, that's the question. I don't know if we can get an answer to it as to whether clients do feel a certain type of way about going to massage parlors and whether they do think... I think it varies, like anything, of course. The reactions that I think I've read some research on, like, what clients think about their sex workers or the sex workers that they see, and I think some folks do think that they're exploited and some folks don't at all. Some folks can just see what's in front of them in terms of the conditions that they're going into to see sex workers. But yeah, I mean, hand jobs for everyone.
Let's back up and talk about, like, you know, hand jobs are funny, and so you insert a hand job into a sentence and it's funny, but, like, what's really behind the hand job? It's the new VH1 series.
Behind the glass hand job.
In all seriousness, you know, what are, like, why are people into that? Why do, by and large, yes, it's men. It's cisgendered men you know, a lot of diversity within that designation, but cisgendered men are sex work consumers, vast majority. So what are they after? They're after satisfaction, but also, like, you know, everybody masturbates. There are probably some sex worker clients who can't, who feel guiltier about masturbation than they do about hiring someone to masturbate them. That's a thing.
Absolutely.
But there's also quite a lot of people who can give themselves that kind of satisfaction, and who can, you know, if you have, I mean, let's just say that you have, you know, $20 to spend on porn, or $50 to spend at a strip club, or $300 to spend for an hour with an escort or a BDSM provider, you know, or, you know, $40 to spend on cam shows, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you could spend that on going, you know, you could certainly spend it on a, like, Swedish massage with no happy ending, which would be beneficial to your health and relaxation. You could spend it on any other experience that would give you that sort of, like, service indulgence. So why sex work? I mean, I think excitement, right? And danger, the same kinds of things that we were talking about that are often the adrenaline rush that is true for workers. And part of that adrenaline rush for the client as well as the worker comes from stepping into this realm of the forbidden, right? So doing something that you are told that you're not supposed to do. And then, like, yes, all of the reasons that people want sex for pleasure, because it feels good, because it makes you feel powerful, because it satisfies something, like, more, like, an urge that has some sort of psychological origin. And then also, like, fucking company and intimacy, and, you know, there are many kinds of sex work that provide the experience of intimacy, which is not necessarily an illusion, any more than, you know, the person making your coffee, like, making eye contact with you and smiling and saying that they like your tie is an illusion. Like, in the sense that it's fake, like, the minute you walk out the door, like, the barista or the whore, like, turns to someone and says, like, oh my god, I fucking hate that guy that I just told that I really like his tie. Like, that, of course, is also real.
That's a thing.
But, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, I think that some people want to hire a sex worker because they want general sexual stimulation or a particular kind of sexual stimulation, with that is, like, no strings attached, right? So they in a sense, they want intimacy without intimacy, like, they want, or they want pleasure without intimacy, or they want intimacy without commitment. You know, I think that there are definitely some people who are too ashamed or shy of the particular proclivity that they have, like, they're a foot fetishist, or they are, like, actually, like, really turned on by trans women, and they, you know, they, like, don't want to be out about that in, about, you know, that in real life, so they, like, turn, you know, an entire group of people into a fetish, or they turn, like, a, you know, something that is just about bodies, like, foot fetish into, or, like, or, you know, an interest in feet, like, into a fetish. So they hire somebody because then they don't actually have to, like, ask their partner or ask their date to do that thing for them. And sometimes, perhaps, even people would prefer to do those things with someone that is not their partner, that doesn't know them. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. Like, you know, you like to, you know, I like to drink coffee and make vegan dinner and, like, talk endlessly about sex work with you. And then I have other friends who I will, like, go for a run with. And I have other friends who I will, well, that other friends that I will have sex with. And other friends that I will, like, tell all of my, that I will, like, call when I need a good cry. Not that I wouldn't call you, but, you know, like, we have different relationships with different people, and we like to do different things with them, and, right. and be different people with different people. So sometimes that compartmentalization is easier to do when you're paying for somebody's time. I don't know. Do you think have I missed something? Do you think that there are other motivations for wanting to hire sex workers?
I mean, there's I don't know if you've seen this online, there's like this running joke about New York City about how like a year, if someone's in a relationship for a year in New York City, that's like the like numbered equivalent to like 3 years if you live in like Denver or something, right? Like if you live in a less quote-unquote, sorry, Denver, I'm saying that you're less cool. So if someone from Denver is listening, I apologize in advance. But, like, if you're from a more remote place or a rural place, maybe you're a queer person, there's less queers there, like, you're more likely to stay in a longer relationship vis-a-vis New York City, where folks' relationships are potentially shorter because they have access to more stuff.
Right.
And I think that probably also plays out in how folks access sex in cities versus in rural places. I mean, sure. I think for folks that are in more isolated places, it might have to do with, this is literally the person that they're able to find who can do this thing.
Right.
And, I mean, we do live in the wonderful age of the internet, and people have so much more access to being able to find people who do the thing they want to do than they ever did before.
Yeah.
But that being said, you know, isolation is still isolation, and plenty is still plenty. And so in New York City, you have access to an innumerable amount of things that you could ever want to stimulate you in 1,000 different ways. And I think that that's a big, probably a big part of the sex industry in New York City, is that you can just sort of bop around to all kinds of different stuff and try a bunch of different things. And that's a possibility for you as a consumer in New York.
Right. I mean, it's true about food, and it's true about, you know, art and, you know, clubs and, you know, every other kind of social interaction or situation. Yeah.
Kimchi tacos
and
foot fetish hand jobs. I mean, they just, there's all kinds of fusion happening in the city.
One of my favorite things about Smitten Kitten is that I know that they are so non-judgmental, and they are totally sex worker and sex worker client friendly. They have the great gear and the best safer sex supplies that all sex workers and clients need, and you can visit them online at smittenkittenonline.com to get all those needs met. Thanks for downloading or streaming episode 11. You can listen to every amazing episode of Why Are People Into That on our fancy website designed by Justin Levesque, whyarepeopleintothat.com. You can also subscribe on iTunes, and if you just wanted to poke one of those little stars or write a review, it would make me feel like the whore that I am. Other ways of making me feel like a whore include liking Why Are People Into That on Facebook and following at Into That Podcast and at Tina Horns Ass. See you in a couple of weeks for part 2 of Why Are People Into Sex Work. Until then.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.